My brothers and sisters, we're on session 41 tonight, I've been asked to say. And if you remember from last time, we were looking at the conclusion of the first woe trumpet of Apocalypse chapter 9. And we're just gone back to the Gospel of John regarding verse 11, where it says they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue hath his name Apollyon. And we suggested to you that the subscription written over the Master's cross was in Hebrew, in Greek, and in Latin, being the three principal languages of the day. But here we have the mention only of Hebrew and Greek, as the wars which the Arabs and the Saracens under the Muslim banner had was not against the Western Roman Empire, not against the Latin countries, which by this time had fallen, i.e. in chapter 8 under the first four wind trumpets. And therefore it was specially recorded in verse 11 that it was only the Hebrew and the Greek tongue which bear the name of this ruler who was over them. It's also significant, as we suggested, I feel, from last time, that it first mentions the Hebrew and then the Greek, because the first area of attack, basically, was against Jerusalem and then Damascus, before it spread further and further into the Eastern Roman Empire. Both words, either taken in the Hebrew, Abaddon, or in the Greek, Apollyon, means destroyer. And this, of course, is what they were. They were the destroyers of the area of the world which we know as the Middle East, and of course then affected and destroyed quite a considerable amount of the Eastern Roman Empire. The fact to be borne in mind, as we have stressed all along, is it was never given under the first woe trumpet, i.e. to these Arabs, these Saracens, to completely destroy and overturn the Eastern Roman Empire. That was going to be left until the second woe trumpet, as we shall start considering later this evening, God willing. But they did have a considerable impact upon the Eastern Roman Empire, and in many ways it's a very apt description which in verse 11 is given to their ruler, that their name was Abaddon and Apollyon. So we'd just like to conclude our consideration of this first woe trumpet by reminding you once again of the historical sequence and setting to it. Most of this we have gone through before, but it will help us perhaps to bring together all the thoughts of this trumpet. Now, Muhammad was born in the year AD 570 in the city of Mecca. When he died in AD 632, most of Arabia had fallen to the religion of Islam. The gentle, faithful, and prematurely old caliph who appointed him, who succeeded him, was a man named Abu Bakr, and he gave his blessing to the holy war with very specific instructions. Remember, there were certain things which he told them they could and could not do. Syria was fell to the Mohammedan armies in the year 635. This man, Abu Bakr, died after reigning only for 2 years, and the vast conquests of Palestine and Mesopotamia fell to his successors, and there was many which fell in a very short space of time. Gibbon, in his Decline and Fall, states, in the 10 years of the Caliph Omar, that's the one who succeeded this Abu Bakr, the Saracens, the Arabs, reduced to his obedience 36,000 cities or castles. They destroyed 4,000 churches or temples of the unbelievers and erected 1,400 mosques for the exercise of the religion of Mohammed. 100 years after his flight from Mecca, the arms and reign of his successors had extended from India to the Atlantic Ocean, over the various and distant provinces which may be comprised under the names of Persia, Syria, Egypt, Africa, and Spain. Under the unifying banner of the Prophet, the Arab warriors burst out of their hot, dry homeland in the abyss. Behind them lay a peninsula, one-third buried in sand dunes. Ahead of them was an irresistible lure. Booty for those who lived, paradise for those who died fighting the unbeliever. One Arab historian says, "The believers smote and slaughtered till the going down of the sun, and the fear of the Arabs fell upon all kings. The Catholics either renounced his religion, or became Mohammedans, or fell victim to the torment of the locusts." The elected caliphs came to an end, as far as the first succession of them was concerned, in the year AD 661, and then the Umayyad, that O-M-A-Y-Y-A-D, dynasty of the caliphs commenced. The converted population of non-Arabs were required to pay high taxes. This caused considerable conflict within the empire, and this, together with internal unrest and conflicts, brought this dynasty to an end in the year AD 750. The first caliph of the next dynasty, which was called the Abbasid, was succeeded by a man called Al-Mansur in the year 754. And he was the real founder of this new dynasty. He created the power base for the new state and built the city of Baghdad as the capital of the new succession. Gradually, the caliphs became an inaccessible figurehead and lost political power until, after the death of the caliph Harun al-Rashid, the empire experienced a speedy decline. Finally, in the year AD 932, the caliphs lost their political power altogether and were confined, and the caliph in particular was confined to be a spiritual head of the faithful, whilst the government of the state was left to the powerful emir. So that basically is all what we've considered under this first woe trumpet, that there was these two periods of 150 years, a 300 period altogether, where the Arabs had a war against the Eastern Roman Empire and made great inroads into that power. And therefore, as verse 12 says of Revelation chapter 9, one woe is past, and behold, there come two woes more hereafter. Now, before we conclude with our thoughts on what happened under the first woe trumpets, although as far as the revelation of John is concerned, their power, as far as it affected the overturning of the Roman Empire, had come to an end. Their work in the purpose of God had been accomplished. The things what we have got to acknowledge is that wasn't the end of the Muslim power. It was, as far as a political force was concerned, against Constantinople and the east of the Roman Empire. But of course, the faith of Islam and the power of the Muslims has come down the generations, even to our day and time. And therefore, because we read in the ninth chapter, the first woe is past, that doesn't mean to say that's been the end of them. We've suggested to you in the past that this has worked many times in the purpose of God. It was necessary for Babylon to come to a complete and utter end. But it was also necessary, in the case of Egypt, for it to remain down the ages of time to be a base nation even today. So although there were many prophecies which had to do with these powers in the past, and because they fulfilled their role in the purpose of God, it doesn't mean to say that all of them ceased to be. And this was particularly the case with the Muslims. They had fulfilled their role as far as the first woe trumpet was concerned, but their power, their influence, has come right down to today. Now, We won't bore you with too many details, but I do want us to appreciate some of the power of the Muslims today, and particularly as far as their beliefs are concerned, because I feel this is very significant. You remember I've bought quite a few books last time, and I've bought some of them again today. Now, one of the things which all of them find remarkable is that it links Islam, that's the Muslim faith, with both Christianity on the one hand and Judaism on the other. There are only three religions, they feel, which they call the religions of a book. And of all the other religions, whether it's Buddhism or whatever it may be, they feel that there is only three religions extant in the world today which are based upon a book. Judaism, obviously, the things of Moses, Christianity, the things of the Bible, and Islam, that, obviously, of the Quran. Now, the other remarkable fact which most of these Gentile writers have to say is that they can't find anything in the Quran which is not to be found, or at least alluded to, in either Judaism or Christianity. Now, obviously, I have not studied the Quran by any means to be able to dispute whether that is so or not. But these, obviously, authorities, which, of course, having their books in print, are open to great criticism, seem to be all agreed that the religion of the Muslims is based to a very large extent upon either Judaism or Christianity. Now, that in itself, they feel, is remarkable. Because basically, the spread of the Muslim faith has probably been greater than any of the other two, certainly greater than Judaism. And therefore, they wonder why something which is obviously based upon two great faiths as Christianity and Judaism should have such widespread popularity. And none of them seem to be able to understand why the Muslim faith is such a dominant faith in the world today. Most of them, again, feel that generally when religions are based upon another, they have a popularity for a time and then they wane very considerably and come down just to a few here and there, but not the Muslim faith. It is spread and spread, and there's hardly a country in the world today which doesn't have a considerable number of Muslims. Even in Russia, there's quite a number to be found. And therefore, as far as we're concerned, brothers and sisters, the great thing about the Islam faith as it first appeared in very much a Catholic-dominated society as the Eastern Roman Empire was, is they believed in the one God. So of the sort of 10 basic beliefs of their faith, obviously it extends to many more, but if we could say the doctrines which they support, the first and the greatest is their belief in one God, Allah. Now, of course, this was in direct competition and confrontation with the triune, or the Trinity of Gods, believed by the Catholics. Now, the thing about the one God, as far as they are concerned, is that God must always be in their hearts and minds, and they must pray to him at least five times a day. So every true Muslim will pray to their God five times a day. Now, this seems to be, again, an enlargement or a taking from part of the Judaism religion, which, of course, was based upon the Old Testament scriptures, where the Jews would pray three times a day. You remember the psalmist says that in the morning, at noon, and in the evening would he lift up his voice unto God. And you remember Daniel, when he prayed, also prayed the three times per day. And therefore, they seem to have taken hold of this, and they say that all their believers must pray five times. The second thing which is interesting is all the earth belongs unto their God Allah. And wherever a believer prays, it is holy ground. So that the faith of Islam can be practiced wherever a believer might be. It doesn't need a particular shrine or place or country for them to pray or to have a belief in their God. That obviously is very much linked to our own beliefs. The third one which is linked, is brought before us here, is that equality before God. Now, no man, it says, needs an intercessor before their God. All men are equal. There is no respecter of persons. So they do not put Mohammed in the position of Jesus Christ to be a mediator. Now, obviously, as our own beliefs are concerned, Jesus Christ is the mediator between God and man. But in the Muslim faith, there is no need of a mediator, of an intercessor. The fourth thing, which again is very much based upon the false Christian belief, is that although at the death a man's physical body dies, his soul lives forever. So they believe very much in the immortality of the soul. And whether the soul goes to heaven or to hell depends upon the conduct of the body while it's still alive. And apparently there is great detail given in the Quran regarding heaven, the paradise, and hell, the place of torment. And that is why there is a great belief amongst the Muslims that if they die in the course of their faith, they will enjoy this tremendous paradise of bliss forevermore. Now, when we come to some of the moral codes, as apart from the doctrinal, drunkenness is totally prohibited. Islam considers intoxicating drink as the mother of all evil, and great punishment is brought to bear upon those who are drunken, and therefore to be sober is one of the tenets of their faith. The other point which it mentions here is that truthfulness is of utmost importance. Nothing should be allowed to sway a Muslim from speaking the truth. And therefore, they stand very much to the point that anything a true Muslim says is to be accepted and believed, because no true Muslim would ever tell a lie. The next point, as far as the moral code is concerned, is that adultery is strictly forbidden. There is nothing which Allah abhors more than adultery. And it goes on further and says, the eye and the tongue can commit adultery, which obviously is the very essence of the Sermon on the Mount, when the Master obviously goes further than the actual act by saying, if you look upon a woman to lust after her, that you've committed adultery already. The next point it speaks about is the acts of kindness, the acts of charity, and their general concern for each other. And therefore it is very much part of the sayings of Mohammed that charity, that kindness one to another, should be carried out. And this kindness doesn't just apply to man, but also is their duty to animals. There is no beast on earth nor bird that flies, but the same is a creature like unto you, and to God shall they return. So directly opposed to the wise man in the book of Ecclesiastes, where he says that the birds, that the animals return to the dust of the ground, they feel that animals will enjoy either paradise or torment, depending upon their circumstances. How an animal can obviously be found condemned, I just don't know, but that's one of their beliefs. And of course, the thing which they are in conflict with Christianity, but perhaps more in akin to the teaching of Judaism, particularly in the Old Testament scriptures, is that they are allowed to marry more than one wife. Polygamy is allowed amongst the Muslims. They can marry up to four wives on one proviso, that each one of them is taken care of. They can't get rid of one to marry another, but they are allowed to be married to four at any time, providing the four are supported. And that is practiced even to today. And that apparently is the appraisal of what the Muslim faith comprises of. Obviously there's many variations and that of it, but it does give us an indication of how closely in some respects they are linked to both Judaism and Christianity and seem to be a mixture of all of them. Obviously there's much more could be said, and you can get any of these and many more books from the library. But the one thing which I find is interesting, as far as the spread of the Muslims today, apparently it's one of the fastest growing religions even in today's generations. It is spreading throughout the world, and many, many more people are coming under the influence of the Muslim faith. But the one thing which, and it's too long an article to relate to you, but basically what it is saying, that the fundamental difference between the Muslim faith today and what it has been down the centuries is that it's adapting to change, and the circumstances of the environment in which it finds itself more perhaps than any other faith. In other words, they are willing to bend their faith to suit their circumstances. Now this would be in direct conflict with the teaching of Mohammed itself. But they are finding, and I can only again accept the research which has been done on the matter, there are many examples where if a certain hurdle is in their way, because either politically or socially it might be more advantageous to bend their faith to some degree, they are doing it. For example, one of the doctrines of Mohammedism is certain things like, if someone is caught thieving, one of their basic fundamental faiths contained in the Quran is anybody caught has their hands chopped off. Literally, it's the amputation of the hand for anybody who's caught thieving. Now, obviously, this has brought them into direct conflict with the human rights campaign. And again, if anyone has had illicit sex relationships, they are stoned automatically under the Muslim faith. Now again, not every government, not every country would allow this tenet of their faith to be carried out. And therefore, although Mohammed has said it, although the Quran preaches it, they're having to modify their beliefs to conform to their standing in the world today. Another one seems to be, shall we say, more difficult for them than others. The Quran prohibits altogether putting their money to usury. If they find that they have got more money than they need themselves, the attitude of the Quran is that it is distributed to those in need. They should never invest their money so that they may get interest return upon that which they have invested. But of course, most of the oil-rich countries come under the auspices of the Muslim faith. And they have had great problems in reconciling what to do with all the money they have acquired through their wealth as far as the oil reserves are concerned and what the Quran teaches. And they now have come to the conclusion, and this is what it states, that it does not preclude them from investing on bank deposits or stocks and shares, providing there is a fixed rate of interest. They will not allow their money to go up and down according to the fluctuations of a market. But if they can invest on a fixed rate of interest, then they feel that's not putting your money to usury. And therefore, again, they're obviously having to bend the rules, so to speak, to try and justify their position. And all we're trying to say is basically they are bending more and more because of the social and political pressures which are being brought to bear. And therefore, they feel, and again, I'm only quoting what these editors have said, they feel it's going to become very much in the future a religion of convenience, a religion which they will hold purely so that they can be all bound together under this one common banner. But as far as the sincerity of the Muslims, it will become more and more weakened as, shall we say, the prosperity which they've never enjoyed up until the last century will become more and more apparent throughout their countries. And therefore, you know, it's very significant, isn't it, the way, you know, the truth and particular Christianity has been eroded away because of affluence and because of the social circumstances of the day. And so it is, even with a faith like the Muslim faith, they likewise are having to bend to the pressures which they find themselves under. As I say, much more could be said, but if any of you are interested, go to any library, and according to, you know, most librarians, there's hundreds, literally, of books you can read upon the Muslim faith. But it is significant the way it has spread from the days of Mohammed. It had its purpose in the fulfilment of the first woe trumpet, and it has remained very much a power to today. And that's the basic reason why I believe we have been given so much more detail on the first woe trumpet than we had under the wind trumpet. A, it spread over a greater time period, and secondly, the effects of it are felt right down the ages of time to the days in which we live. Just something which, you know, is interesting in passing. Most of you saw last time the split of the Muslim faith between the Sunni and the Shiite Muslims, and of course we are seeing the effects of that in Lebanon. But if I may be permitted to, we'll pass on now and come back to the apocalypse. And we pass therefore from the faith of the Muslims, from the power of the Arabs, the Saracens, to the second woe, which is now described in verses 13 to the end. Perhaps being as your last night, Brian, we might hear your dulcet tones, and perhaps you could read for us verse 13 to the end of the chapter.
Four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour, and a day, and a month, and a year, for to slay the third part of men. And the number of the army of the horsemen were 200,000, and I heard the number of them. And thus I saw the horses in the vision, and them that sat on them, having breastplates of fire, and upjacing, and brimstone. And the heads of the horses were as the heads of lions, and out of their mouths issued fire and smoke and brimstone. By these three was the third part of men killed, by the fire and by the smoke and by the brimstone which issued out of their mouths. For their power is in their mouth and in their tails, for their tails were like unto serpents, and have heads, and with them they do hurt. And the rest of the men, which were not killed by these plagues, yet repented not of the works of their hands, that they should not worship devils and idols of gold and silver and brass and stone and of wood, neither can see nor hear nor walk. Neither repented they of their murders, nor of their sorceries, nor of their fornication, nor of their thefts.
Thank you. Right. Termed the sixth angel in verse 13, but as we obviously have said, going back to chapter 8 and verse 13, it is the second of the woe trumpets. So we shall be referred to it not basically as the sixth trumpet, but the second woe trumpet. And again, to remind you, the reason that it's the woe trumpet is that the first four wind trumpets were against the Western Roman Empire. The two woe trumpets of chapter 9 are against the Eastern Roman Empire. So what is happening under the second woe trumpet is a following on from what had begun under the first woe until it is brought to a conclusion, i.e. the second woe trumpet is going to see the downfall of the Eastern Roman Empire. If we can just pick up one or two thoughts, just to get the whole of those verses into context, first of all. You remember going back to chapter 8 and verse 12, under the fourth wind trumpet, when that sounded, the third part of the sun was smitten, and the third part of the moon, of the stars, and of the third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise. And we saw that this was the eclipse, this was the downfall of the western third of the Roman Empire. And now, in chapter 9 and verse 18, as a result of the second woe trumpet, by these three was the third part of men killed by the fire, by the smoke, and by the brimstone which issued out of their mouths. And in verse 20, and the rest of the men which were not killed by those plagues, yet repented not of the works of their hands, that they should not worship devils and idols of gold and silver and brass, stone of wood, which neither can see nor hear nor walk, neither repented they of their murders, nor of their sorceries, nor of their fornication, nor of their theft. Again, we've got the killing of the third part. So therefore, the second woe trumpet is going to see that his downfall, the total destruction, the total killing of the second third part, if that makes sense, of the Roman Empire. The first third part was the western one, seen in chapter 8. The second third part is seen now in the Eastern Roman Empire, and the conclusion is the second woe trumpet. The third part, or the third part of the Roman Empire, will be seen in the rest of the apocalypse, because the third part of the Roman Empire is obviously going to refer to the Catholic power, which was obviously emanating throughout the region. But we are concentrating on the second third of the Roman Empire, the Eastern Bloc, and it's the second woe trumpet which is finally going to extinguish that power. It's obviously been corroded, it's obviously been tried and tested and sorely tormented by the Arabs and the Saracens under the first woe. But their final destruction was now to come under the second woe trumpet. Now, the thing which we again want you to keep in context is that in verse 14, as this sixth angel sounded the second woe trumpet, the effect of it was to loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. Now, if you go through to the 16th chapter of the Apocalypse, you will notice in the 12th verse that the great river Euphrates is mentioned again. Now, just to put you in the picture, the 16th chapter, of course, is speaking about the vials which are poured out upon the earth. Now, remember again from your charts, as the seals gave way to the trumpets, so the trumpets in turn give way to the vials, and the vials give way to the thunders. So when we come to the 16th chapter of the Apocalypse, what you find with the list of the vials which are given to us in the 16th chapter, it's the enlargement of the third woe trumpet. Again, as we've seen with the seventh seal, we're not given any details about the seventh seal, because the seventh seal comprises the seven trumpets. And likewise again, we're given no details about the seventh trumpet or the third woe trumpet, because the two are exactly the same, because the seventh trumpet is given as seven vials. So what we've got in the 16th chapter are the details of the seven trumpets, the sounding of the third woe trumpet. And one of these vials is mentioned in verse 12 of chapter 16 as the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. And the eventual outcome of this sixth vial is given to us in verse 15. Behold, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that watcheth and keepeth his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame. And he gathered them together into a place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon. And all that takes place under the sixth vial. And of course, we therefore are today living under the symbology of the sixth vial, because the master, behold, I come as a thief, of verse 15, has not yet arrived. And therefore, the details of the sixth vial are the days in which we are living. But the point which I want you to notice is how that it affects the great river Euphrates. And the effect of the sixth vial was the drying up of the great river Euphrates. Not the river literally, as we shall see in a few moments, but that which is symbolized by the great river Euphrates. So you must link that back to chapter 9 and verse 14. Because what we have under the second woe trumpet is the bursting of the banks of the great river Euphrates. And what we find in the second woe trumpet is the overflowing, the flooding of the power represented by the Euphrates, whereas under the sixth vial we've got the drying up of the same power. Now obviously, as far as the apocalypse is concerned, there's an awful lot going to be said between chapter 9 and chapter 16. There's a lot of detail which is given to us in chapter 10 to chapter 15. But none of it is basically going to affect what we're going to consider under chapter 9 and what we've just looked at under chapter 16. Because what is being represented in chapter 9 and chapter 16 are one and the same power. In the first instance, as they come to power and as they overflow the banks, as it were, of the Euphrates and flood the whole of the territory which they are going to occupy, whereas in the 16th chapter we've just got the reverse. We've got the drying up. We've got the cessation, basically, of the power which rose to such considerable heights in the 9th chapter. Between them, most of what's going to occupy our thoughts is going to be either chapters again about the kingdom age for encouragement, or God's dealing with the Roman Catholic system. And therefore, basically, chapter 9 to chapter 16 are linked together with first the uprise, the rising to power of that symbolized as the great river Euphrates, whereas in chapter 16 we have got the cessation, we've got the drying up, the coming to the end of that same power. It's very, very significant, brothers and sisters, the way that God has arranged these chapters. Because as we come to the end of the details in chapter 9, as far as the great river Euphratian power is concerned, chapter 10 gives us a great glorious picture of the kingdom. It gives us a picture of the rainbowed angel, the Lord Jesus Christ, with his saints, as he will become victorious in his conquest of this earth. And again, when we go to the 16th chapter, behold, I come as a thief, and he gathers them together in the place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon. Again, we've got the dramatic picture of the return of the Lord Jesus Christ. The Spirit is indicating to us that as the power comes onto the scene in chapter 9, like other nations which have been used in the purpose of God, their time to come to an end will finally arrive, and as far as this power is concerned, it will herald the arrival of the Lord Jesus Christ. So again, I apologize in advance that the second woe trumpet is going to be more history. But the only comfort, as far as we're concerned, in the history, apart from the way that God has worked in the nations in the past, is that the cessation of this power, which we're going to look at in great detail, is heralding the coming of Messiah. The events which have taken place upon the world scene only in the past years, as far as this world is concerned, have been begun under the second woe trumpet here in chapter 9. So although we're going to go back almost a millennium as far as the earth is concerned, as far as history from this time period is concerned, we're going to go back to AD 1000. Nevertheless, it brings us all down the ages to our very day and generation. That again is the reason, I believe, God has given us far more detail concerning this power of the second woe trumpet than we had under the wind trumpets, because not only was it to occupy a great period of time upon world's history, but the effects of it were going to be seen down to our day and generation, the same in effect as the Muslim power. Right, having said that, let's come back to chapter 9, verse 13, and see how it all begins. The sixth angel sounded the second woe trumpet, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar which is before God. If you go back to chapter 8 and verse 3, that golden altar is mentioned there. Another angel came out and stood at the altar, having a golden censer, and there was given unto him much incense, that he should offer it with the prayer of all saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. As we saw when we considered chapter 8 and verse 3, this took us back to the law, to the things of the tabernacle, and related to the altar of incense, by which the incense was offered as a symbol of the prayer of the believer. And we looked again in the Psalms and other places to show how Scripture supports the principle that the incense altar and the offering of incense is connected, as chapter 8 verse 3 says, with the prayer of all the saints. So if you take the thought back to chapter 9 and verse 13, the events which are to appear under the second woe trumpet come as a result of the prayer of the saints. The voice from the horns of the golden altar which is before God give us the aspect of the voice of the prayer of the saints, which ascended up continually before God. Now one can reflect on this and say, well, in one respect, because the purpose of God has been determined before the beginning of time, before creation ever became a reality, God, knowing the end from the beginning, would know exactly how that purpose was to be worked out. And there would be no way, one could argue, that the prayer of the saints could alter one iota that predetermined purpose. As the same argument relates to the coming of Christ, the day has been appointed in which the Lord Jesus Christ will return to this earth. And that is true. The die has also been set in which he will judge the world in righteousness. Everything has been predetermined. And therefore one again could say that as much as we pray, as hard as we pray, as many as pray, won't affect the day of the Lord's coming. And yet we are exhorted through the scriptures to pray earnestly for his return. We are told to give him no rest until he makes Jerusalem a praise and a rejoicing in this earth. We are told to pray without ceasing, how long, O Lord, until thou dost not judge our blood upon the earth. And therefore, brothers and sisters, we've got to bring the two into perspective. Whereas it is true that we do not alter that which is being predetermined of God, nevertheless, God works according to his purpose, but he desires that the saints will offer their prayers unto him to show their desire for the fulfillment of that purpose. We obviously do not know when the Master will come. We know from the signs around us that it's imminent, but that doesn't stop us, brothers and sisters, praying earnestly day by day for him to come tonight. And that's what the Father desires to hear from each one of us. Although the time has been set, nevertheless, we are commanded to pray without ceasing for his return, because obviously that is well pleasing before the Father. And so it was here. It was the prayer of our brethren and sisters ascending before the throne on high, where God heard and answered their prayer as he brought the answer to what they had prayed, the vengeance of their blood upon those who dwell upon the earth. And this was now going to be apparent as God was bringing his final judgment upon the Roman Empire. And so the second woe is going to see the total collapse, the total demise of that great power which had ruled the world for so long. And so the prayer of the saints, ascending to the Father, the instruction was given to the second woe trumpeter: loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. Now again, we've seen many times the use of the word angels, the idea of the messengers who do the work of the Father. And these four messengers were to be loosed from the great river Euphrates. Now, you'll notice, first of all, as far as the authorized version are concerned, the four angels are bound in the great river Euphrates. Every other translation I've looked at, rather than word in, puts at. They are bound at the great river Euphrates, rather than contained within the great river Euphrates. Now, it has been generally accepted as Christadelphian teaching for many a long day that the Euphratian power relates to the Turks, to the Ottoman Empire. And much has been written in our publications regarding the great river Euphrates symbolizing the Turkish power. Now again, without question, the Euphrates is the main river of Turkey. There is no question about that whatsoever. And therefore, it is not unusual for a river to denote the power which it goes through, i.e. if somebody was to think of England and somebody was to mention the River Thames, one would automatically think of London and therefore the power of Britain. Again, we can think of the Seine, we can think of the Danube, we can think of many similar rivers. And it is generally accepted that being the Euphrates is the river of the Turks, of Turkey, than the power represented by the Euphratian is that of Turkey. Now, one thing we can say, brothers and sisters, whereas that may be fairly logical, one thing we cannot dispute. What we are going to read under this sixth trumpet, this second woe trumpet, is certainly from the history books fulfilled only by one power, and that was the Ottoman power, the Turkish power. What we are going to see from verse 15 onwards throughout the chapter is almost, as we would expect it to be, an appraisal of what the Turkish Empire did to the Eastern Roman Empire. It's amazing the accuracy again of the symbols which are used in chapter 9 as they relate to the Turkish Empire and the effects they had upon the Eastern Roman Empire. The same will be seen also in the 16th chapter, where it's only a few years back that the Ottoman Empire ruled the majority of the Middle East, and mainly it was through the work of the British power that their power was reduced to the country which we now know as Turkey. So just for the time being, we'll accept that the Euphratian power is a symbol of Turkey, and we will read from Gibbon and others to show how that the details of this second woe trumpet fit exactly the testimony of history. Now, you'll notice in verse 15, the four angels, the four messengers, the four that were represented as being at the great river Euphrates, were loosed. And they were prepared for an hour, for a day, for a month, and for a year to slay the third part of men. Now, if we can take the last phrase first, the third part of men is to be linked to verse 18, that what was going to happen through the loosing of this power represented by the Euphrates River was the destruction, the slaying of the third part of men, i.e. the eastern third of the Roman Empire. Again, if you want to link it back to chapter 8 and verse 12, as the fourth angel of the wind trumpet brought to an end the western third of Rome, so now the Euphratian power, symbolic of Turkey, is going to bring to death the eastern third of the Roman Empire. And therefore, as these four were loosed from the great river Euphrates, for the time period which is stated in verse 15, the outcome of it all was that the third part was going to be destroyed. So as the power was released, and as the effect of this power became rampant, for the time period which is indicated in verse 15, the eventual outcome was to be the destruction of the Eastern Roman Empire. Now, if we can take, therefore, the time period next, before we come to the actual four angels and what they represented. If you look up at that time period, and if you add them up, or write them on a piece of paper to add them up, you will notice you've got 1 year, 1 month, 1 day, and 1 hour. Now again, using the same time periods as we have done before, a year is 360 days from the Hebrew calendar, not 365 and a quarter as we have it in our calendar. A month is a month of 30 days. A day, of course, is a day, and an hour is an hour. So we have got 391 days and 1 hour, which is represented in verse 15. Now, using the same principle as we've used before on the day for a year principle, and we read it in our readings on Saturday from the book of Numbers, when Israel were caused to wander in the wilderness for 40 years, and the Spirit word says, for every day that they searched out the land with the 12 spies, the day for the year principle would apply, and therefore God would cause them to wander for 40 years. Do you want the reference, Trevor? You're looking puzzled.
No.
No, you're right. Right, it's in Numbers 14, for those who do want to turn it up, but I mean, we've looked at it so many times. So the 391 days becomes 391 years. The hour is the 12th part of the day. Remember, we work from the Jewish calendar on the morning and evening period. It's a 12-hour day and a 12-hour night, not the 24-hour clock which we use. And therefore, the hour is the 12th part of the day. And therefore, a 12th part of the year is 1 month. Therefore, upon the very same basis which we have considered before, we have represented for us 391 years and 1 month. And therefore, from the loosing of this Euphratian power until it fulfills the purpose of God in slaying the third part of men was to be exactly 391 years and 1 month. And you will not obviously disbelieve, because we are going to show from Gibbon this is true, but that was exactly the time period which the Ottoman power needed to bring about the destruction of the Eastern Roman Empire. It commenced on the 27th of April, AD 1062, and it ended on the 28th of May, 1453. 391 years and 1 month, and history records the details. The 27th of April, 1062, to the 28th of May, 1453. How much time have I got, Charles? Oh, 2 minutes. Right. Now, we won't go into the history. We've only got a couple of minutes left. What next time, God willing, we will show is firstly from the history books, the beginning of the power of the Turk. We will show how it began, not in such a dramatic way as Mohammed, but nevertheless, there was a very distinct starting point as far as the releasing almost of the power of the Turk, as it's described here in the Second World Trumpet, and through the various things which happened until he brought about the total end of the Roman Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire, in 1453. And then, from then on, we'll look at the symbols which are given in the Second World Trumpet and see how remarkable the accuracy of them is compared to the details of history. And therefore it's remarkable again to me, brothers and sisters, that the very hour almost of the very day of the year in which these things were to be accomplished is given to us well in advance, of course, of when they actually were fulfilled. Which leads us to conclude once more. It's the Most High which ruleth in the kingdoms of men. Only he could have prophesied in such accuracy the details of the events. So we will commence next time with the thoughts of the history, and then we'll have a look at the four angels which are loosed from the River Euphrates and to see what they represent.